I never considered that all of the stuff that I'd put myself through throughout my life was having impact on me on a daily basis as a mother and as a drinker. So it took me to go to therapy to unravel all of that stuff. Actually, I don't have to do this to myself anymore. I don't have to be horrible to myself, because that's what my drinking was doing. It was, you know, affecting my mental health in the end. It was making me really wobbly in everything I do. And I worked out that I didn't trust myself. I never had my own back, which is quite a frightening thing to be confronted with.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. I'm really pleased to talk to Victoria Vanstone. She's a self-confessed drunk mother gone sober. She's the host of a brilliant podcast called Sober Awkward. Victoria is also the author of a brilliant book called 1,000 Wasted Sundays. Coming up to the holidays and Christmas, I asked Victoria some tips how to get over Christmas or how to get through it and cope with not drinking. She is in Thailand at the moment traveling with her children. So Victoria and I did this as a recording from home. So it might sound a little bit different, may look a little bit different. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hi, Vic. Welcome to This Is Powerful. I'm really excited to talk to you. I've been watching you on Sober Awkward, and I said before that I'm just a halfway listening through your book. And I went to an event last night, so I took the train, so I was listening to it, and some of it was cringy because it brought back some memories, yeah. And some of it was bloody funny, and you really write well, so congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
For those who don't, you in my audience, don't know you yet, I'd love to know a little bit more about you, where you're from and how your upbringing was.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. It's always the upbringing, isn't it? With this sober game. Yeah, I'm from Reading originally, actually Wokingham, a little town in Berkshire. I grew up in a little village where there wasn't much to do. And of course, one of my favourite pastimes was getting wasted with my friends. I grew up in a family that always loved drinking. It was a kind of frivolous style of imbibing alcohol, I guess. I wouldn't use the term alcoholic because I didn't know that word back then.
And was this in the 80s?
This was in the 80s. Very similar to you, I think, Paul, yeah. Actually. You know, I grew up in a family where drinking was how you had fun. Drinking was how you relaxed. You know, it was kind of that yuppie period where everyone was kind of, you know, flashing the cash a little bit and wanted to
holding
show off.
Holding file of faxes.
Totally. Snorting coke off it, usually. Mm. And my parents, I have lovely parents. I don't blame them. I mean, they were doing the best that they could with the tools that they had at the time. And they drank to have fun and let their hair down at the weekends. And of course, to join in the kind of cheerful pandemonium, as I describe it in the book, it was kind of my legacy, my legless legacy, to join in that family and be holding that party mantle high and carry on the family tradition, which was to fall over drunk as much as possible. So I had four older siblings growing up, and they all started partying before I did, and all I did was want to join in. I just wanted to be accepted and to carry on partying with the rest of my family.
But when you was younger, did you see, so I understand it because I was born a little bit before you, I believe, but it sounds like a similar thing. And I think for me, late 70s and 80s, it was very much in my environment was more of a pub culture. Mm-hmm. And we had a house at the end of the street where we had all the parties, and it was actually a very nice community. So I saw the benefits when I was younger because it was very warm and fun and great. Mm-hmm. But then after a certain hour, things would turn a little bit sour. There's a rhyme for you. Yeah. And I was quite a sensitive kid. So for that, for me, I saw kind of an ominous warning sign early. Mm. But still loved to join in. And I never drank when I was younger. I tried Guinness when I was about 14, 15, and thought it was horrendous. Mm. and apparently had drunk a bit of wine from my mum's glass when I was about four, which was embarrassing, apparently, and that was it. But did you see early on, before you wanted to join in and stuff, did you see early on, like, a downside to it?
No. I think that was partly my problem. I never considered there to be any downside. I was prepared to take a hit, whether that was mentally, physically, or whatever. I knew, even though I'd read and, you know, heard at school that alcohol was bad for you, I totally ignored all of that information, because being accepted and showing everyone that I could bring the party was more important. So important, in fact, that it became my entire identity. My persona was based around being the person that you could party with, being a reliable drinker, and, you know, bringing wherever we were. If there was a pile of mud, you know, I could string up a, you know, string of lights and bring a bottle of Pimm's Ice and Slice, and I would set up a party for everybody. So yeah. I became a reliable drinking buddy, basically. And I never, ever considered the red flags, even though they were whipping me across the face for many, many, many years, until I was 40, actually. I never considered stopping drinking or slowing down or anything like that. But it's funny you mention that, because when we do a live show in our Sober Awkward, we do like live shows around the world, and one of our things that we do during the show is that we read from our old diaries. I've got diaries, you know, from my late teens to early 30s. And each page in that diary is quite shocking, because as I say this, I realise actually it's a bit of a lie. I was aware, because one page is, right, I'm going out, I'm getting pissed tonight. There was promiscuity, there was recreational drug use. It was all in there. And I'm kind of going out and I'm looking forward to it. And I've got that euphoric high that, you know, you're going out and you're going to have fun that you get before drinking. And then the next page is the come down from all of that. And it's me in bed with massive anxiety. And I'm even using in, I think it was 1998 I read, which I was only sort of 20 years old, I'm saying I need to be sober. So whenever I was hungover, I was aware of the consequences of alcohol, but I never took it further than that day. By the Thursday, you know, I was over my anxiety, the hangover was gone, and I was waving a tenner at the barman again. So I obviously did have some awareness that alcohol wasn't right for me, but at the same time, it cleared up. It was kind of like, once the hangover's over, right, I'm going to carry on. So I just chose to be hungover and go, okay, this might be not good for me, and then ignore the rest of the, you know, complications and consequences, which I guess a lot of people do. We're prepared to take that hangover as a hit because of the fun, and we use our happy coins, as we say. You know, I used my happy coins the night before, so therefore I had to pay them back the next day.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because it's there's different, I've had the same conversation with different people, but you seem to have like a jolly slant on everything. And actually some of it's probably quite devastating at some times, because in the morning that anxiety is no joke. No. And what we do to our brains and our bodies and our heart is no joke.
No.
I mean, I remember, God, I was in Milan doing Milan Fashion Week, and I think someone brought some champagne out at lunchtime, and I thought, oh yeah, let's have a little bit. And then if I didn't drink, I was okay. But once I started, I couldn't stop. So I just carried on. And I remember waking up, I think 3 o'clock in the morning, roughly, in the hotel, like no clothes on the bed. My buddy was on the other bed, and I was, you couldn't drink the water out of the taps there. And we drank all the water. There was nothing else to drink. And I remember just trying to down this water in the hotel room, and then I ate a bar out of the mini bar that tasted really bitter, and I couldn't eat it, and I didn't know, I thought something was wrong with my taste buds. Anyway, when I come to in the morning, the bar was so green and furry, it looked like an enlarged caterpillar. So it was already been open and off, and I was just trying to sober myself up. And I can laugh about that stuff, but when, you know, there's another side to it where it's actually pretty harmful.
Yeah,
you kind of gone right the way through to your 40, but when you're in your teenage years, like, what was you doing for work? Did this affect your work?
I've never really had any priorities apart from, you know, getting wasted. There was something that happened in my early teens. I used to go to a school in a place called Didcot, and I had these two amazing best friends, and one day I showed up at school and they never spoke to me again. And I know we talk about trauma is very, very heavy, and I believe that trauma that for me was huge. And I see it as a turning point in my life, as where I went really off the rails. Until that point, I was a bit off the rails, but that heartbreak as a young teen and losing my two best friends definitely caused some sort of trauma within me. And I had a reaction, which was to not care about myself anymore. So before that,
so you kind of switched off your emotions because it hurt so much.
Absolutely, I think I did. Yeah. And it took me a very long time to realize that that was the catalyst for abandoning my body most weekends. It was the reason why I drank more than everybody else, while I was always last man standing on any grubby dance floor, whether that was, you know, in Thailand, in Brighton, or wherever I was at the time. And it was the reason I never self-reflected, I guess, because I just wasn't prepared to reflect on that pain. I just thought, well, this has happened to me. I'm going to pretend to get over it. I'm going to pretend it's okay. But that situation was really heartbreaking to me. And trauma, I realize now, is relative. It doesn't matter, you know, if you, what level of trauma. I understand that, you know, some trauma is a lot worse than others. But for me, it doesn't sound dramatic, but it did have consequences.
No, trauma is your own experience. Your own pain is your own pain. And trauma can be simply being neglected by someone, or turned down, or being broken up in a relationship, or it can be horrendous. Yeah. So it is relative, and things are traumatic. It's really important what you said, because there's a lot of people that listen that may not know these experiences can have that effect on them. And I think it's really powerful what you said about I made a decision as well. To detach when something happened to me when I was younger, and I consciously said, I'm done. I am not going to connect at all with anyone. And it's a smart thing to do at the time, because it keeps you safe. Mm. But the problem is we take ourselves with us.
Yeah, totally.
And it's always inside, right? So the thoughts and the feelings are there somewhere. You just push them down and push them down and push them down.
I think also the problem with doing that, which was what happened to me, was that stopped me reaching out for help, because I didn't think that my trauma was big enough to be, you know, able to get help for. I just thought, well, I'm just a silly party girl. I'm just an idiot who does coke every weekend and gets pissed. No one's going to take me seriously in an AA meeting. And even if I went to see a therapist, I'd be laughed out the door because I'm not an alcoholic. My problem isn't severe enough. I'm not waking up with a bottle of Jack Daniels, you know, clenched to my chest in the morning. I'm just an over drinker, a socially normal binge drinker. That's how I sort of represent myself. That's who I am. So we can kind of get stuck in this mindset that our problem isn't big enough for deserving somebody else to step in and take a look at it. So I carried on for years and years and years going, well, I'm not like him, Jack. I'm all right. I'm like everybody else, which of course meant that my alcoholism, as it were, got absorbed by the people I surrounded myself with. It kind of got diluted by the crowd.
Well, it's a very subconscious thing that we do, which is smart. And it's like being a good interior designer. You just decorate yourself and smother yourself and people worse.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can hire. I went to a thing last night, which was a good party. I stayed there for like 20 minutes and I was done. But I could see it back in the day. It would have been brilliant. And the people in there would have drunk probably more than me and been doing coke probably more than me. So I'd have just looked like I'm okay. I'm not as bad as them. And it's a clever way of doing things, but it's very damaging, isn't it? Because it can just keep you going to the end. I remember I had a friend of mine. I won't mention his name. He had a beautiful house in London, and I'm sure it was designed purposefully, but it had a mirrored bathroom. And I mean, even the toilet seat was mirrored, the whole thing.
Wow.
And I remember doing some coke in there with him on the toilet seat. And I looked up at him. I said, in a dead serious thing, I think you might have a problem. I think you might need to go to rehab. And he just looked at me and said, seriously?
I don't think I'd want to see myself on the toilet, quite honestly, on a mirrored bathroom, but hey, all to their own.
Yeah, well, I wasn't looking at myself, trust me, but yeah. But these conversations are really important, because there's so many people out there that aren't alcoholics or who are middle lane drinkers, or people that are on this perpetual cycle. You know, and it is a subject where I, for many years, was totally against talking about stuff like this. I was like, don't be so boring. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Come on. And I was part of that whole culture as well. And obviously I had a serious downside for myself. So what compelled you to start the podcast? Because you're so candid. Have you always been that way?
I think it's a very magical way of reaching the ears of people that wouldn't normally listen. So I say that I'm a comedy writer and I'm a comedy podcaster, but I'm talking about a very, very serious topic. And somehow that, you know, it is a lot of what we did is funny. A lot of the behavior, a lot of the pissed up, ridiculous things that I did are funny stories. And I'm not going to take that away. I wasn't myself at those times. Therefore, I have no blame. I have no shame. It was alcohol doing what alcohol's supposed to do. It's an addictive substance and I wanted more. That's not my fault. That's society's fault. You know, that's everything that I was brought up around. That's media. That's environment. That's all of those things. Alcohol was always coming for me, no matter what. I always say this when I'm interviewed. It was coming for me. I feel no shame at picking up that drink, but I had to take responsibility for taking another one. Because when I was brought up in this wonderful family and everybody drank. It was Ladette culture. You know, I lived in Brighton, Fat Boy Slim playing at the Big Beat Boutique. It was that era. So no matter where I went or what I did, I felt like it was coming for me. And I don't feel like I should take the blame for that. So that sort of lessens the heaviness of my drinking issue. It makes it a lot easier for me to handle. Because if I sit in blame, I'm just going to feel angry and I know it's futile and it would hurt people I love. What's the point in that? So I'm trying to lighten up this subject so that people have access to it a little bit easier and people don't feel that shame and feel like they're worthy of support like we spoke about. I think there doesn't have to be all of the podcasts and books and everything. It doesn't have to be sad. I know a lot of it is sad and I know you'll get to a point in my book where you will feel sad, but that's just part of my journey. That's not all of it. Some of it has been very jolly. Some of it has been very weird and that's okay. So I'm trying to highlight a jolly part of it and talk about it. So it's a way that people can access this information a lot better. I'm hiding behind a smile, bringing you an option, saying, look, I'm going to try and nudge you to thinking about your drinking. I'm not saying stop. I'm not saying anything else, but this is my story. This is how I feel. And maybe if I give you a little nudge and a little, you know, toilet humor, then maybe you might listen to me. If you like me, then maybe you might listen to my message and go, actually, I hear what she's saying. And so it's all based around that. Yeah.
It's interesting because there's a difference between blame and taking responsibility, isn't there? And clearly you took responsibility at points. You're obviously passionate about it. Where does the passion come from? Because it's interesting because you're, on one hand, you're saying they're great stories and stuff, which I agree with as well.
Yeah.
But also you're passionate to help others.
Yeah, totally.
Does the passion come from? What's the goal?
I think passion comes from pain generally, doesn't it? So I had children. I'd been drinking up until I was probably 38, binge drinking at the weekends. I had my first child. I tried to combine these two worlds of being a party animal and a mother. Obviously, those worlds collided. That is not a good combination. You've probably had a you've been sober a lot longer than me.
No, I know, but you described that so well in the book. I loved how you described it. And I was so with you because you said about, you know, not losing your sparkle, mourning the loss of the party girl.
Yeah.
And you said, which I did laugh at, you said that you can still hold the trophy, you know, go out on weekends and still do that.
Yes.
And be a mum.
Yeah, I was desperate to do that. I thought, this kid isn't going to change me. I'm just going to still be the person that everybody else wants. I was taking the responsibility and the illness that I got from drinking because I was actually people-pleasing. Really, that's what it came down to. Yeah. I wasn't enjoying it, but everybody else was because I was this fun-time girl. You were guaranteed a good night if I was around. So I was doing it for everybody else, I realized. And after having my first child, I tried to combine these two worlds. I was attempting moderation, of course, then just waking up, going out with good intentions, waking up terribly hungover, anxiety pumping through my body, but having a baby to look after. And then after having my second baby, I woke up 6 weeks after she was born with a massive hangover. It sounds outrageous. I didn't know what else to do. I thought that's what mums did. I thought we, you know, let our hair down and got pissed. And that's what I was trying to do. And I woke up that day and just went, oh my God, I'm failing at curing this problem myself. I wasn't taking responsibility, and I decided that morning I walked into the lounge to my husband and said, what I'm doing isn't working. I'm not getting any better. I'm still drinking. I've still got anxiety, and I need to reach out for support, which is where my sobriety journey sort of began, even though we hate that word journey. I won't say it too often, I promise. And the why I started everything I do is because during that first 18 months of my sobriety, I felt very, very alone. I didn't know there was this term, sober curious. I didn't know there was all of these people out there that perhaps weren't extreme alcoholics, that were binge drinkers, that were questioning their alcohol intake. So I felt very alone, and I started writing about feeling alone. I started my blog, Drunk Mummy, Sober Mummy, because I needed people. I needed people that understood me, and it wasn't there. And I couldn't find anyone. So I thought, well, if I can't find anyone, I'm going to start something. So I just started meetup groups where I live. And then the blog turned into the podcast, and the podcast turned into the book. And it's just wonderful. Like, you know about the sobriety community. It's just incredible how these people come together, and all you need is that why you here, and then you get the full story, and that is the connection. There's no chit chat at sober groups. It's like, why are you here? And you get a massive connection with people straight away, and that's what I enjoy, is connections with people that get me, which I think you can lack when you get sober.
Yeah, I totally agree. But when you started to write the blog, did you see the therapist? Because after you said this bravely to your husband, and he sounded like he was quite a legend in his reaction to you, actually. Did you decide, how long after that did you go to see a therapist? And then when did the blog come around? Was that before or after?
Yeah, well, I think after that morning with my husband, I just literally reached out and phoned a local therapist that specialised in addiction. I booked myself in for the Monday morning.
So you found that she actually found addiction therapist. Was that in Australia?
Yeah, it was actually really random. It was just a number I looked up online, and I just booked myself in to the first person I saw that was an addiction therapist. And I was really lucky. I will say this, you're not always so lucky with a therapist. People always say, oh, I didn't like it, I'm not doing it again. But I was really lucky, and I found someone that was really, really helpful and understood me. I thought I'd phone up and she'd go, sorry, love, you're not a real alcoholic, you know, go to AA. But actually, I wasn't ready for that. I wasn't ready to stand up in front of a group of people. I think AA is amazing for loads of people out there. But at the time, I don't think I was brave enough to stand up in front of a room of people. I just needed to go and do something on my own and work out what was wrong with me, because I didn't really feel like, I thought this is about giving up drinking, stopping and starting. I thought it was as simple as that. I never considered that all of the stuff that I'd put myself through throughout my life was having impact on me on a daily basis as a mother and as a drinker. So it took me to go to therapy to unravel all of that stuff. And then after I finished, I kind of walked out of there, you know, kicking my heels going, actually, I don't have to do this to myself anymore. I don't have to be horrible to myself, because that's what my drinking was doing. It was, you know, affecting my mental health in the end. It was making me really wobbly in everything I do. And I worked out that I didn't trust myself. I never had my own back, which is quite a frightening thing to be confronted with.
Did she say one thing like that sentence for you to know? Because it's quite, therapists, yes. It's brilliant that you went to a 12-step therapist or someone who knows about recovery, rather.
Yeah.
But you have to be open, because you can listen, but maybe not hear. And it's about hearing, isn't it? And Was there a penny drop moment through the therapy?
There was an absolute penny drop moment. I think there always is. I work really well with that sort of visualization where somebody's saying, like, imagine you're here, and cutting the ties with people and all of those things. And she said to me, Vic, imagine you're on a merry-go-round, right? And everyone you know's on it, and they're all drinking, they're all smoking, they're doing pills. Like, it's absolute chaos. This is your life. Like, imagine what that feels like. And it's spinning around and there's rubbish everywhere. She said, step off and look. Just step off and observe what's going on there. And I remember just feeling, having my eyes closed and stepping off and going, it is that simple. I can step off this and I can observe. And I felt the actual kind of weight of 25 years of binge drinking just fall off my shoulders, because I realized it was up to me. It wasn't my environment. It wasn't my mate going, come on, let's stay for one more. It wasn't the pub next door. It was none of those things. It wasn't drinking culture or media, all those things I've blamed all my life. It was my responsibility to stop perhaps not to start, but it was definitely my responsibility to stop. And I realized then it was my hand waving that, you know, tenner at the barman and reaching for the drink. And I remember going home that night after we'd had that conversation, and the kids had been being naughty, and I was kind of like all over the place. And I remember opening the fridge and reaching my hand in to grab a bottle of wine, just like, you know, like I always did. And I just remember thinking, this is up to you now. And just withdrawing my hand and closing the fridge and just going, right, this is, I'm taking responsibility. I'm not going to, that's making me cry actually thinking about it. I haven't said that for ages.
That's so powerful. Yeah, it was a powerful thing.
It was such a powerful moment because I realized that actually, you know, I could be on and off this, but it's always going to come down to my choice. And that was the choice that I made, and I've never had a drink since.
Oh my God, that is such a beautiful thing. It's so important for people to hear that because it is a choice. And I think the visualization, I got that as well. It's incredible. It does. We had Andy Ramage on, and he said a really good thing about when you're in the jar, you can't read the label.
Oh, so true.
And it's incredible because we're on this merry-go-round and we're doing this stuff. And God, I remember making the similar decision. It's kind of surreal because it is a choice, but before it's not a choice.
Mm.
And I think it's really important that people hear that because it is a choice, but you need to stand back and have a look.
Yeah. And that
was
takes
that emotional
practice
at the time?
Yeah, I remember it being emotional. It was a big realization for me that I was in charge. As I said, I didn't have my back. I didn't trust myself. I knew that if I went out to a party, in fact, I'd started to deny invitations towards the end of my drinking because I knew myself so well. I'm going to go out, I'm going to have one, then there's 10 down the hatch and I'm snorting a line of coke in the toilets. That's just how it goes. So I realized that actually I'm in control of that. Not anybody else. It sounds ridiculous now to say it that I didn't realize that, but it took a lot of work and a lot of kind of walking the walk and talking the talk for me to understand that I had to have my own back. Even if my husband does or my kids do or anybody else, it had to come down to my choice. And people often say to me like, Vic, how do you do it? How have you never relapsed or anything? It comes down to that. That's my reason why. My choice was to give up drinking, and I choose to stick to that choice. And of course I get cravings sometimes, like I go to work for the day and then I see a lovely cold beer going by right past my eye line, especially on holiday. I go, oh yeah, I remember I used to do that and I used to like it, but you know, there's a reason why I don't do it anymore. So I can always come back to my reason why. And I think that's a really good message for anyone. Like, why do you want to quit drinking? Is it because of anxiety? Is it because you want to be a better mum? All of these reasons, and write it down and always come back to that in those fleeting moments of, you know, wanting to go out with your mates and that moment of euphoria you have at that first drink. It is so short-lived. And is it worth it? Yeah, so the reason I haven't drunk again is literally because I go back to that moment that we just discussed and think, yeah, it is my responsibility and I choose not to do this anymore.
It's so beautiful. It's so powerful because it is important that people hear that because I never knew that I had a choice. And I love what you said about people pleasing. People pleasing is so powerful and dangerous.
Hmm.
I used to people please all the time because I wanted to be liked, because I didn't like myself.
Yep.
And I always say to people, I wanted to get out of my head. The reason I wanted to get out of my head because I didn't like being in it. If you don't like being in it, what can you change to like being in it? And I think that moment, what you described, is incredible because you know where it goes.
Yeah.
And you don't have to please anyone anymore. And actually, it's incredible because people start getting attracted to you, don't they? So you're actually getting a better sort of self-esteem and friends and a good group, but in a positive way.
It's incredible, really, because you do think it's about drinking and not drinking, but it ends up not being about that at all. It's not about alcohol. It's about you and about learning who you are, which can be confronting and it can take some work. And it is, you know, over a long period of time. I don't think my sobriety kicked in till about 2 years in. I mean, I was happy until that point, but then I really went on this kind of, you know, sort of looking inside who I was. It sounds all cheesy and woo-woo, which is everything I am not. But I had to go and find out what I'm made of. And that is hard work and, you know, can involve all sorts of different processes. I mean, I took up pottery. I go boxing now. Like I just did my Muay Thai class this morning. Like all of these childlike joys that I used to have before drinking have all started to come back. And that's been one of the most loveliest processes, and it will be for everybody else. And I know the beginning is hard and it feels too much and you feel like a social outcast and all of these negative things, But what comes from those is that you look yourself in the mirror and go, actually, I'm all right. I don't care what anyone thinks about me. That is one of the most wonderful, you know, reactions to sobriety is you don't care what people think about you. And well, for me, that's huge. Yeah.
It's massive. And it brings self-esteem. And I've changed to saying I'm doing childish things, right? Because I did the same. I did martial arts, did a black belt, then did pottery, did acting, done so many different things, standing on my head for 8 hours and meditate. I tried everything.
Yeah.
I did psychodrama. I've done all the stuff from being fetal position, crying on the floor, going, what's going on?
Love it.
to laughing. But the fact is that a friend used to say to me, I used to say, I'm going to go away for a break. I'll go to Mauritius or somewhere like that and have a break. And he's like, how was that? And I was like, oh, well, it wasn't really great. And he said, you know why? Excuse me. And I said, no. He said, because you took yourself with you.
Ah, yeah. Very good. You're your own baggage. Said,
and you are the baggage. Yeah, exactly. So if you clear up your baggage, which actually can be really fun and empowering and insightful, and it gives you a deeper understanding of yourself. And I believe that you get deeper relationships with other people because you understand yourself deeper. And you should go there, but you don't have to be glum about it.
No.
In fact, I find that my sober group, we're so irreverent and so funny about stuff because we've done the work.
Yeah.
And it lightens itself up by doing it, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I had an amazing chat with, I don't know if you know, Jean McCarthy. Highly recommend having a chat with her. She had the podcast called The Bubble Hour, which has been around for years. She's amazing. And she talks a lot as well about this sobriety capital, which is like the scaffolding that holds you up for a continual and long-lasting sobriety. And for me, that was really true. Like, I stepped into it with support around me and with the right people and the right circumstances. And I think when people just try and go sober on a whim and, like, don't really think it out and are hungover and decide to do it, I think sometimes that doesn't work. It can be quite short-lived. You have to go into it with a full sort of safety net underneath you and have the right people around you to be able to kind of keep that scaffolding strong, because that capital will fall away if you start umming and ahhing and you haven't got anyone to talk to about it. So that's why these online communities, I know everyone hates social media, but for the sobriety community, for somebody online, for somebody who is, you know, in a remote area and is giving up drinking, it is absolutely incredible. Like, you can reach out 24/7 and find someone who's going through what you're going through. And that has been the backbone to my sobriety and the capital and the scaffolding, all of those things, is knowing that there are so many people like me.
So when you started the blog, what was the reaction from starting that? Did it take a time to get people in? And then when did you start meeting up with other people that are not drinking anymore?
Yeah, I think there was no one reading the blog, of course, at first. I had to kind of share it out and be annoying to all my Facebook mates and say, please share my post, please share my post. But yeah, eventually people started reading it and liking it and resonating it with it. And I found that there was this gap between a pub and an AA meeting where people weren't getting the help that they deserved. And that is really my niche, is anyone that's ever had a hangover but doesn't feel like they're worthy of going to an AA meeting. And I think I found a little place where I sit very comfortably, in fact. And that comfortability, if that's even a word, was relatable to others. And the blog just became more and more popular. And as it did, people started reaching out saying, can I meet you? Where, you know, do you have a group? And I remember the first meeting I had, it was men and women, which was actually a mistake, because sometimes sober women, some of their drinking might have to do with an abusive partner or something like that. And for me, we had a mixed meeting, and some of the men were there, not all men, I'm saying, of course, were there to kind of meet other sober women and kind of hit on them. So I ended up actually chucking the men out of the group, which was a bit of a shame, but created a beautiful group for women locally where I live. And now that's expanded to our cuppa community, which is, you know, for men and for women, for anybody who is going sober and wants to find out about events or any question whatsoever. You know, we run, you know, camping weekends. You can ask any question on cuppa. It's a free community. It's like 10,000 members. It's absolutely amazing.
And how do you fund the meetings and camping and stuff like that?
Well, the cuppa community is actually funded by the community. I do a shout out every year and say, look, I've got to pay the fees for the platform and the money's in my bank the next day. It is the community creating this community for others. It's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, and everything else, everyone gives me a $2 coin donation. That's about it.
Do you know what? There's something important about self-funded things, though, because you are investing in yourself and you're invested in your group, and that grows spiritually as well. And I think when you have, well, for me, I can speak for me that I have real intimate conversations, and I thought an intimate conversation was on the beach with a girl with a joint and a glass of champagne years ago, but clearly not. But to really, when you offer someone what you've been through and your pain, and not in a past tense, that this is what it was like, this is how it is, and how I am now. It's really powerful for someone to open up as well, isn't it?
Well, I think all I have to offer is authenticity. That's all I have now, is my honesty and my story. I can't change that. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm proud of who I've become. You know, I've made mistakes. I've done some horrible things in my life. You know, I've treated myself more than anyone else very badly. But I feel like, well, who cares? Everyone's done shit. Everyone's ran down the seafront with a traffic cone on their head, half naked.
They just don't tell you.
They just don't tell you. Yeah.
So Sober Awkward, such a good title. How did that come around?
I started the podcast with my friend Lucy, and we decided to really think about, what does sobriety feel like in the beginning? What is it actually doing to us? And the first word that we came up with, how do we feel? We feel extremely awkward. I always liken it to going into a social situation with, you know, a bright light being held in your face. You can hear your voice for the first time. You can hear the room. You can see everything. It's really raw and real, and it feels incredibly awkward. And of course, with practice, that gets easier. But awkward was the perfect word to describe how we both felt in our early sobriety. And yeah, it's been amazing, because the podcast reaches so many people all over the world. We've won the best wellbeing podcast in Australia last year. The event is on next week, so hopefully we're going to keep the title, but we'll see how that goes. But I now host it with a guy called Hamish, and it's incredible how he's opened the net. He has given up drinking for the podcast. So he is not a problem drinker. We call him the normal lad. And we're sort of logging the journey of somebody who doesn't have a problem, but who is still gaining all the benefits of stopping alcohol from a health perspective.
How did that come about?
I knew him. Lucy had left the podcast, the girl I used to do it with, no hard feelings. She just wanted to kind of tie her sobriety in a box and move on. And I met Hamish on the beach, and he was so charismatic and had done podcasts before. And I was like, actually, this is a story worth telling. If he can give up drinking and we can log this, this is to show, look, it's not, giving up drinking doesn't have to be for an alcoholic, which of course is the best place for it, but it can be for anybody who has negative impact from alcohol. Anybody who wakes up with a hangover and thinks, I don't want to do this anymore, or is getting anxiety, or it's affecting their work ethic. All of those things come into, you know, this issue, this social issue. And he's a great representative of that. You know, he's someone who has come into this not knowing how he was going to feel, but is gaining so much from being sober. He's been sober for probably 2.5 years now. So he's a really good advocate for people who are questioning their alcohol intake.
Yeah, which is brilliant. What is your guide, your 30-day sober kickstart?
Oh, yes. So we filmed a funny sort of 30-day series. I'm the shady shaman in it. So I sit and I say, bring on my Bentleys. And he's kind of the stats lady, Moody Margaret. And we've got these ridiculous characters, which probably some people won't find funny, but we found it very funny filming it. And it's just a 30-day guide. Every day there's a different episode telling you what to do, how to get, you know, how to not only start getting sober, but how to have a long, healthy sobriety. Yeah, that's available on soberawkward.com.
What would you say, and this isn't common sense for everyone, but what has been the benefits for yourself or Hamish, who doesn't have a problem?
I mean, what aren't the benefits is more likely the question, isn't it? Like, yeah. I didn't know that I could be someone who I hated that was sober. I would have taken the piss of that, you know, the sober person at the end of the bar ordering an orange juice where I was having a pint with my mates. I would have been like, this person is a total loser. I don't want them anywhere near me. Probably because I didn't want them to remember my behaviour either. If I could remember what I was doing, I certainly didn't want anyone else to remember it. So I don't know. It's really interesting. I think the benefits just are that now I can go into a social situation and feel comfortable there. And that's taken a long time. And it's been a stepping stone. I tried to kind of liken it to a brick wall. Like, I went out for 10 minutes the first time, it was horrible. I went out for 15 minutes the next time and it was okay. And each time I went out, I built a little wall in my confidence, added a brick every single time. And by the end of it, now I can step into those situations, be fully myself. And that is, you know, I walk away with my head held high rather than bowing in shame. And that is a massive change for me.
It's huge. And there was a photo, that I saw yesterday, you holding up, I think it's two jugs.
Yeah.
And I looked at your eyes in there and I felt really sad because I have a picture similar and you can see there's no light, no spark, no nothing in the eyes. And the irony is that you said you didn't want to lose your sparkle, right?
Yeah.
I was in Los Angeles. My agent basically came to see me and walked up to me, looked at me and had tears in their eyes and literally said, what's the matter? And I said, nothing. What do you mean, what's the matter? And I said, you've lost your spark. Mm. And I immediately thought, that's because you haven't got me any work. But the actual fact was, I'd lost my spark. And I work with a lot of guys. They came in and the internal narrative is, we've got to keep going. We've got to impress. We've got to go out, do this, be this person. And I look at them and their eyes are completely dead. And it's so sad. So what I'm seeing now is you've got a beautiful look in your eye, a beautiful spark. And it's incredible because you're a mother. And with my children, like I just come off a school run and I was driving along and my little girl said, Daddy, can we listen to Taylor Swift? And I was like, of course we can. She said, can we turn it up, please? I was like, yeah, let's turn it up. So we had a little party in the car driving towards the school and she was laughing, I was laughing. And there's just a beautiful intimacy that I don't believe can happen if you're drinking or if you're hungover.
I totally agree with you. I mean, it's that authentic joy, isn't it, that you get to have that presence with your children. Your story just reminded me of a WhatsApp group that I have with all my Brighton mates. And one of them posted a picture. Normally, I don't care about pictures about me. I'm like, oh, whatever, that was those days. I don't really care. But one of them posted a picture of me hovering over a toilet. For some reason, I had a monkey sewn onto my shirt. I have no idea what that was all about. What a weirdo. It was kind of my mate for the night. And I'm kind of, you can see I'm out of it. And I call it the dead shark eyes. You know, I've got these black eyes. The lights are on and there is no one home. There is no joy. It is just nothing. And I got really, really upset. It was the first time that I've seen myself and looked back in time and gone, that is someone who is very unwell. And that's what sobriety gives you. And as in respect to the children, I know that my choices, I don't know whether my children will drink or not. Of course, I hope that they don't. But I feel like, whereas perhaps I didn't have a choice, I feel like at least I'm giving them the choice. We don't have alcohol in our house anymore. I try and not get people to drink there. But of course, when you're from a family that's big booze bags, that's quite hard. But I think that's all I can do as a mother is I'm not perfect. I still probably shout too much. I find it very empowering to be a cycle breaker. And that's all I can do. And that's what I'm trying to do. Whether that means they drink or not, at least they have the choice. And at least I tried. And somebody said once, you know, don't ever underestimate a cycle breaker. And that is a really fantastic message, because do not underestimate someone who changes the line of a generational issue that's been going on for so many years. It is one of the most impactful things you could do in your life.
I was told, some of the older guys, I do 12-step programs as well, but one of the older guys said to me that by breaking this cycle, it can have an effect on seven generations.
Whoa, I've never really heard powerful. That. That's amazing.
Yeah, so when I studied as a mindset coach, we did timeline therapy, and you can, some of the questions about when you do like a regression, can be traced back genealogically as well. So there is a pass down, and I think it's incredible to break that chain, because if the families aren't like, my wife has a glass of champagne now and then, or she'll have a beer now and then, that's it. So we have it in the house.
Yeah.
But the narrative isn't there. The energy's not there and all that. So it's not going to be there. So it will be a choice, hopefully. And hopefully, like me, they won't be addicted. I pray for that. But it is about, it's, you know, like where you are now, look what you're doing. You're in Thailand, you're taking kids at a gang school. What an amazing experience. You could have been Brighton in a flat, hungover with all of them. And it's just completely different. It's incredible.
It is a completely different life. And also sobriety, it's not, as we said many times, it's not about the alcohol in the end. It's what happens after it. It's about who you were before it came along. You know, before it came along, I was quite a happy kid. Like, I was confident. I was actually an extrovert. And I think I did the opposite to most people, was I numbed out the fact I was an extrovert. And it's taken me a long time to realize that I'm actually an extroverted person, and that's okay. And it's about all the other benefits that happen to your life, like with work. I never imagined in a million years I could write a book. But here I am. I've got another book coming out in April about being a mum. Like, I could never imagine this life for me. And it's a wonderful joy. And I don't say that to be a wanker and show off. I say it to people to say, just try it, just see what it's like, because I know that I was suffering because of alcohol, and I was getting anxiety, and I didn't know who I was anymore, and I'd lost my confidence, all of the repercussions from my drinking, just from having that yay isn't this fun kind of drinking habit, developed into me having all sorts of psychological issues and social issues and everything else. So it's looking beyond that and looking beyond what we're told, that alcohol is fun. It's looking outside the box and taking those blinkers off and going, like, what else is there in life? Is there something else for me that doesn't involve this, you know, very normalized social drug?
So it's so well put. Someone said to me about alcoholism, it's a symptom. So like, if you have a cold, you get a runny nose. If you take away the runny nose, you still have a cold. But if you take away the cold, you don't get a runny nose. And I loved that, because when I looked at myself, a lot of it was because I was unsure of myself. I had low self-worth, and not all the time, but moments and bouts of it. And that just took it away. But what alcohol did in the end for me was take everything away.
Yeah.
Shot me to bits with my nervous system and anxiety and stuff. And I'm really happy not to be there anymore.
Yeah, me too.
One last thing. What would you advise some of our listeners if they are curious about becoming sober or stopping drugs, or if they generally know they've got a problem? What would you suggest?
Always what we say on the podcast is, you know, you are deserving of professional help. I didn't have anyone around me that knew what to do, and I certainly wasn't helping myself. I couldn't solve. I was proving every weekend that I couldn't solve my own issues. It was just a fact. The more longer it went on, the more proof it was that I was failing at solving my problem, and that the problem was alcohol. I mean, I went into that therapy session thinking, oh, I'll just learn how to be a better drinker and I'll learn how to moderate. But of course, that didn't happen. So I just think I'd say to anybody, you are, no matter where you sit on this vast spectrum of alcoholism, it is massive. It might be a one drink a year at the barn dance to a bottle of Jack Daniels in the morning. It doesn't matter. It's not about how much you drink. It's about your own mental relationship with booze. And if that is having impact on you, then you can reach out for support. There is a level of support for everybody out there, and it doesn't matter the quantity.
Victoria, we're coming up to Christmas, and this can be a difficult time for some people because of peer pressure, society. I remember I always felt like I was obliged to drink no matter what, because it's part of the conviviality. What tips would you give for people coming into this Christmas if they don't want to drink, or they're fearful of going out because they don't have a choice, or they feel they don't have a choice?
I think it's definitely a good idea to chat to the people that you know before the big day, for example. Like, you don't want to have these serious conversations, these one-on-ones about your drinking habit while the turkey's being served on Christmas Day. I think it's a good idea, even if it's in a WhatsApp group or however you communicate with your friends and family, is to, you know, go for that walk, that shoulder-to-shoulder communication when perhaps you don't have to look into someone's eye. Sometimes that can be quite helpful. And just tell them what's going on with you and tell them your honest feelings about alcohol, that you're scared about it, it's not working for you anymore, and have those, you know, lines set up so you can be honest about how you're feeling about Christmas. I would definitely say, if, you know, alcohol-free beers or any sort of alcohol-free drink, whether that's a fizzy water or a glass of milk, have that prepared for you so you're not stepping into a situation where everybody's going to be drinking and you don't have something to celebrate with. Get some bloody parrots on sticks and a few umbrellas as well. Like, decorate your drink like Del Boy. Make yourself a big cocktail, a big mocktail rather, and then have a nice, you know, plush drink. I think that's a really good idea, because you still deserve to have a nice looking drink on Christmas Day. Definitely explain your sobriety before you go. Make that little mocktail bar. One thing I do occasionally on Christmas Day when my family's around is I just step outside for a bit. I might go out onto the balcony and get a bit of fresh air, and I have to reset myself. And in that moment, I might play the tape forward. I love that saying, that sober saying of like, what would happen now if I drank? I would have that glass of Bailey's over a, you know, game of Trivial Pursuit, and the night would be over. That would be it. Or I could go back in there and enjoy myself and, you know, recharge and go, right, this is how I'm going to handle this day. I'm going to do it sober. I'm going to be authentic. And I'm going to really absorb this time with my family, because Christmas is lovely. Like, why do we always black it out? I used to have the worst hangovers on Christmas Day, because it was that kind of time where everybody came back from uni, you'd meet in the local pub, and you'd be absolutely hungover as shit on Christmas Day. So don't do that. Like, try and absorb these memories. I think it's important to also place some boundaries when it comes to Christmas. I think there's an important point here, is that you can say no to going. It sounds like you're cutting people off and people might be angry with you about it, but in early sobriety, safety is the most important thing, and you want to keep yourself safe and you want to keep your sobriety safe. So if that means you don't go, you just go when they open the presents and then you leave secretly, even backdooring, they call it over here. You just sneak out the door when no one's looking. They're probably all going to be drunk and they're not even going to notice you've gone. But as long as you keep your sobriety safe and put some boundaries in place before you thought about it and thought about going, then that would be a good idea. So basically what I'm saying is plan for it, because Christmas can be very confronting, and there's going to be your Auntie Margaret and your Auntie Steve on each elbow saying, come on, have another one, it's Christmas Day. So you've got to go in there knowing that you're not going to drink, and you've got to, and if not, if you can't do that, I think you've got to stay away.
I think that's very, very, very wise words, and I'd agree with that. Thank you, Victoria.
My pleasure.
I think they call that the French slip when you go out the back door, right?
Well, it sounds rude, though, doesn't it? I think that happened in clubs in London, rather in Soho, rather than...
yeah, probably.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.